Okay, thank you. All right, so I mean, this talk will be to explain something, you know, which is the following, which is that somehow there are indeed, you know, two basic spaces which we'd like to know a lot better than we do at the moment. And I mean, they sort of stand behind the two names which are here. So the first space is the space of prime numbers, all right? And of course, I mean, you know, this space of prime numbers, when you sort of explain it in very simple terms, doesn't look something very hard. I mean, you know what is a prime. And, okay, and when you look at the distribution of prime numbers, I mean, there is a conjecture by, you know, by Riemann, of course, which tells you that, I mean, the sort of asymptotic formula which is due to Gauss, namely the fact that the number of prime numbers which are less than n or less than x is very well approximated by the integral logarithm. So the integral logarithm is given by the integral from 0 to x. I mean, you jump over the singularity at 1. And it has an asymptotic expansion. And this asymptotic expansion is a very strange thing, because if you want, it's the prototype of a series which is asymptotic without being convergent, because the nth term is behaving like a factorial. Okay? So, and then there is the basic problem, which is a test of whether you really understand prime numbers or not. And the basic problem is this, that, I mean, the in the simplest formulation, the remainder, if you want, in the Gauss formula should be of the order of square root of x log x. Now, some people will tell you the reason why we cannot prove this conjecture and all that is that we don't have a formula for the number of prime numbers which is less than n. We don't, and then, okay, you tell them, oh, come on, I mean, it's a recursive function. But their answer is, we don't have a simple formula. There is such a simple formula. It's quite old. It has more than one century and a half. It's due to a mathematician who is called Laurent, okay? And the formula, if you have some time to spare, and if you think that what I am saying, you know, is all things you know very well, you can amuse yourself to prove this formula. So you see, it's a very, very simple formula. It's a sum from 5 to n of a ratio of two trigonometric functions. And in a trigonometric function that you have here, you have the of course, the difficulty is that, you know, it's in the phase, you have something which is very large, which is a factorial. It's an exercise in elementary number theory to prove this formula. So if you want, the problem is that when you have a formula like that, it doesn't help. It doesn't help at all to give you some control on the asymptotic behavior. Okay? And now, of course, the work of number theorists and of Riemann went much deeper, if you want, in the asymptotic expansion, I mean, in the behavior of prime numbers. And so I just want to set the scene and remind you of what is the basic ingredient. So the basic ingredient is a product formula which is due to Euler, and which tells you that if you sum the inverse of the numbers, okay, to some power, then you can rewrite this as a product over the primes. So there is this basic, if you want, a feature that it's like, if you want, the primitive elements and so on are given by the primes. So you have this product over primes. And then, okay, if you look at Riemann's paper, in the first page of his paper, there are two different proofs of what is called a functional equation. There is a proof that we all know by theta functions, but there is another proof by the formula of residues, which he gives. So, I mean, basically, there is this function which has this symmetry. And, of course, what Riemann found is that there is a quite deep relation between this behavior of prime numbers, how they behave for large n or large x, and the zeros of the function. Okay, and the zeros are just, yeah, I mean, it's not an absolutely one-to-one plot in the sense that the size is a little bit, you know, the first zero is 14 something, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, this is the picture. But it is the picture for the zeros which are above the real axis. And, of course, this is a critical line at real of s equals 1/2, and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, when, you know, people doing quantum chaos, when they look at this type of picture and so on, they find it very suggestive. They find it very suggestive of systems which occur in quantum mechanics. So, I mean, a number of people have been motivated by what is called the theory of quantum chaos. And I've been trying to find, I mean, the most notable are like Michael Berry and John Keating, and they've been trying to find a system which they gave a name to the system, which is called the Riemann flow. So what they were trying to do was to find a system, a classical system, which is operating on some phase space X, okay, with a Hamiltonian flow, Ft. And then they sort of spelled out the properties that this Hamiltonian flow should have, so that they're, you know, the analogy that they have in mind is the following, that when you do quantum mechanics, you also have functions which look like this step function. What is this step function? It is a step function that is counting the number of zeros which are with imaginary part less than a number e. And of course, it's a step function. It first jumps at the first zero, which is 14 something. And it keeps jumping by one whenever you cross a zero. Okay? And what Riemann proved in his paper, this is a little further in the paper, when you look, you'll find out that what he proved is that there is an asymptotic formula. Now it's not for the number of primes, it's for something which is dual, if you want. It's for the number of zeros which are imaginary part less than e, or positive imaginary part. And his formula is the following. So it has an average part, if you want, this number of zeros. I mean, it cannot be a smooth function because it's jumping by one whenever it crosses zero. Okay, so it has an average part, and it has an oscillatory part. So the oscillatory part is there to compensate exactly for these jumps. Right? And the average part, Riemann computed, and what he found is that it's equal to, roughly speaking, if you want, whereas the number of primes which are less than n, you know, you have to divide by log n. Here you have to multiply by log e. It's sort of dual situation. So, I mean, the number of zeros which are less than e, it's e over 2 pi times log of e over 2 pi minus 1, and then there is a term which is 7/8, and then there is a little of 1. So there is this nice smooth function which is really going through very nicely, you know, through the zeros. I mean, even much nicer than with the number of primes. I mean, it's a much, much nicer way. And so when people in quantum mechanics, you know, and semi-classical physics and all that, look at that, what they want to do, they want to find system, mechanical system, with a phase space X, which is a symplectic space, and so on. Okay, and which has then the properties that you have some Hamiltonian flow, and that when you will quantize the system, then what happens normally in semi-classical physics is that when you look at the corresponding Hamiltonian, which has been quantized, it has this discrete spectrum, let us say, and when you count the number of eigenvalues for this Hamiltonian, it looks like this too. Namely, it has again a behavior like, you know, the number of eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian n, if you want, where the Hamiltonian h is less or equal to e, well, it's equal to some volume in phase space. So the volume where, if you want, in phase space where you have a vector which is where you have h of psi less than e. Okay, so this is the Hamiltonian. This is the quantized thing. This is the semi-classical stuff. And then there is some oscillatory piece. So this is the average piece, and this is the oscillatory piece. And the average piece is supposed to be a volume in phase space. Okay? So people tried that, as I said, you know, especially Michael Berry and so on. But then they met a very bad stumbling block, okay, a great difficulty. And this great difficulty is the following. This great difficulty is that when you go a little further, you know, so you can get started. It's not very difficult to get started. It's not very difficult to see that what you should have, just from simple considerations, is that the flow that you have here should have periodic orbits, and it should have periodic orbits whose lengths are the log of the primes. I mean, this is not very difficult. You know, this is something you can just find out very simply. But what you find out after a while by looking more closely is that there is a catch. Very big catch. And this catch is the following. So this catch is that there is a sign problem. There is a sign issue. So I'm just reminding you very briefly of what is a framework and what is set up. And then we'll go very quickly into the main role of non-commutative geometry in this stuff. So, I mean, there is a sign problem, which is really very serious. And the sign problem is that when you look at the oscillatory pieces, in both cases, okay, what you find out is that the vibrations in the oscillatory pieces are exactly opposite of each other. Namely, what you do a little bit, you know, you take the log of the Euler product, it's a sum, you expand and all that, okay? I mean, you don't want to justify everything because it's really a question of seeing whether the two things are similar. And what you find is that in the Riemann zeta function, when you look at the oscillatory term, you know, in the counting of zeros, then what you find out is that this oscillatory term actually has a minus sign in front. It is indeed looking very much like what it would be from a Hamiltonian system, but there is an overall minus sign in front. And you can try to fudge, you know, you can try to say, well, we have a Maslow index here, and so on and so forth, but you'll never get anywhere, because the minus sign has to be consistently minus one. It cannot be minus one to some power. Okay, you see, when you compare the two formulas, there is a number m, which is the number of times you traverse the orbit. You can go several times around the periodic orbit and all that. But whenever you write Maslow indices, they will be raised to the power m. So, I mean, it's going not to work. I mean, it cannot consistently give you an overall minus sign. Okay? So, I mean, this was very long ago what motivated me to be quite interested in this problem. And the reason, if you want, is sort of a reason which is intuitive and okay, which is sort of difficult to transmit by a formula, but which allows to go. If you want, it's more a picture than a kind of reason that you can write as a formula. And it's a picture which is coming from physics. And this picture is the following. So, I mean, what it means, what these people are doing when they are trying to find, if you want, a system, a quantum mechanical system, and so on, they are trying to describe the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, which are here, from a spectrum. And spectra in physics, it turns out, if you want, that, well, we know what a spectrum is in physics, so this is an example of a spectrum. This is a spectrum of hydrogen, okay, in terms of wavelengths and so on. So this is a spectrum of hydrogen. And this is typical of what is called an emission spectrum. Namely, what you have is you take a body, sodium or whatever, you warm it up, and you take the light which is coming from the body, and you let it go through a prism, okay, and then you get the spectrum. However, it turns out that these are not the most interesting and most typical spectra, because if you look out in the universe, you'll never see a spectrum like this, essentially. Okay? What you will see is a spectrum which is totally different, which is called an absorption spectrum, and which was first discovered by Fraunhofer, you know, by looking at the sun. And these spectra are totally different. Namely, what they are not bright lines on a dark background. They are exactly the opposite. What they are is you have the rainbow here. I mean, it's a pity that I don't have it in color, but you know, what you have here, you have all the colors of the rainbow. Okay? And what you get, actually, you get missing dark lines. All right? So, you see, this is the notion of spectrum that we know in mathematics. This is the notion of spectrum of an operator that we are used to. Okay? And that notion, actually, is a notion that you meet most often in physics. It's totally different. What you get, what happens, if you want, what happens is that in very distant stars, they have an atmosphere, and the light which is emitted by the core of the star is actually going through the atmosphere. When it's going through the atmosphere, there are chemicals in the atmosphere, and they absorb the radiation which is coming from the core of the star. So, I mean, and this is how we get the information about, you know, about the stars, actually. So what happens is the following, is that, you know, mathematically speaking, when you look, you find out that we have only one way to think about spectra, which is the spectrum of an operator in Hilbert space and so on, okay? And it is the emission spectrum, all right? And now, you know, when you see such pictures, you have an obvious temptation, which is to say, come on, here is a minus sign. It's obvious. Because what is going on in this picture is that what you have done, in fact, you have taken something which was a full light, okay, the full spectrum, and you have subtracted from it, okay? But if you have subtracted from it when you will compute, of course you'll get an overall minus sign, okay? So, I mean, this was very, very motivating. And, I mean, about 10 years ago, I found a spectral realization for the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, and it's a spectral realization as an absorption spectrum. Now, this spectral realization, it took some time, if you want, to give it a geometric meaning, and it took a lot more time, actually, and this is, you know, the joint work I'm going to talk about, the joint work with Katia Consani and Mathilde Marcoli. It took a lot of time, actually, to give it a cohomological meaning. So what I will first describe the spectral realization, you know, just in the face, just the obvious one, okay, from a geometric standpoint. And then we'll do some real work to understand what is its cohomological meaning, why it is related to the analogous notion of the Frobenius in characteristic zero, and so on. But first, I will describe it in the simplest possible way. So in the simplest possible way, the way it happens, I mean, the notion, if you want, that allows to describe it in, by far in the simplest way, is a geometric notion, which is that of a Q-lattice. Okay. So there is a geometric notion, which we found with Mathilde Marcoli, which is the notion of a Q-lattice. It's a very simple geometric notion, and it takes some thinking. I mean, in a way, you know, it's as much of a basic example of a non-commutative space as the space of Penrose tilings. It's a very, very basic elementary notion. So to make it even more elementary, I will only describe it in dimension one, because this will suffice for the zeros of the Riemann delta function. And so what is a Q-lattice? I mean, it's something as simple as that. You know, so we take it of dimension one, so to make things even simpler. So we'll take Q-lattices of dimension equal to one. And what is a Q-lattice of dimension one? Well, you know, in dimension one, we have the real line. Okay. So a Q-lattice of dimension one, it will be a lattice in the real line. I mean, okay, this is not much structure. All right, so we have the real line, we take zero, and we have the elements of the lattice. Well, you know, I don't know, some lambda, two lambda, so on. So it's a lattice in the real line, okay? Now, that structure wouldn't be enough, of course, to do something interesting. So there is an additional structure, and this additional structure is the parametrization, if you want, of the torsion points. You see, when you take elliptic curves, if you look at lattices in higher dimension, what you would have, you would take like the complex numbers like divided by a lattice of dimension two. Okay. Now, what we want is a kind of labeling of the torsion points. But what is this? Well, what we want is, if you want a map from Q mod Z, so I will call this lattice lambda. All right. And what we want is a homomorphism, which I call phi, from Q mod Z to the torsion points of the quotient of R by lambda. You see, if I take the quotient of R by lambda, then there are torsion points there, which are the rational multiples of elements of lambda divided by lambda. Okay. So that's a Q-lattice. It's a very, very simple notion. Okay. It exists, of course, in arbitrary dimensions, but I prefer to describe it in dimension one, as I said. All right. So, I mean, that's what we have. That's what a Q-lattice is. And now, the interesting stuff, if you want, happens when we write the notion that two Q lattices, exactly like when elliptic curves are isogenous, so we write a notion that two Q lattices are commensurable. Okay? There is a notion that two Q lattices are commensurable. What does it mean that they are commensurable? Well, it just means that the corresponding lattices are commensurable. That's very easy to understand. You know when two lattices are commensurable, what it means is that when you take their union, okay, or if you want their sum, this is still a lattice. All right? So of course this has to do with numbers which are rationally related or not, okay? So I mean that's for the Q lattices. But what we require also is that the parametrization of the torsion points are the same. You see, if the two Q lattices are commensurable, what it means is that it makes sense to talk of something modulo their sum, because their sum is still a lattice. And then you look at the relation that two Q lattices are commensurable if the lattices are commensurable and the maps agree modulo the lattices. Okay. Now, the beauty is the following. The beauty is that this is an example in your face of a non-commutative space. And what does it mean to be a non-commutative space? Okay, what does it mean? So now we have this. It's an exercise to show that it's an equivalence relation. It's not completely obvious, you know. It's not completely obvious that if you take two which are equivalent and then, you know, one of them is equivalent to the third one, the first one will be equivalent to the third one. I mean, it takes a little bit of doing, but essentially it's because the group Q mod Z is a torsion group and it has no map to a finite group, okay? No non-zero map to a finite group. So it's a relatively easy thing. Okay. But now, you know, this is an example exactly like the space of Penrose tilings of a non-commutative space. And what do I mean by a non-commutative space? All right? So what do I mean? I mean, we are in a school of non-commutative geometry, so, I mean, what is such a space? Well, such a space is a very strange space. This space, the space of Q lattices modulo commensurability. Why is it a strange space? It's a strange space for the following reason. If you take the axiom of choice, it has the cardinality of the continuum. It's not very difficult to show that the cardinality of the set of Q lattices up to a commensurability is a continuum. But the claim
is that nobody will ever be able to construct a bijection with the 0-1 interval. And the claim is, in fact, that if you take, you know, countably many functions, which are constructible, they will never separate points. And it's exactly the same story as with Penrose tilings. It has exactly the same reason. And the reason is that, you know, you cannot distinguish these things from each other, okay, with a finite number of data. I mean, it's not like numbers. You know, two numbers are different. When you look at their digits, you can tell. But not for these two lattices. Okay? So it's a very tricky space. It's a very tricky space. And even though it's a tricky space, okay, what I did in 96, essentially, was to define the L2 space of this space. And I mean, the L2 space was defined by using an averaging map, which is to which we shall come back. And when I discussed this space about 10 years ago, I was not really using non-commutative geometry. I was using a very naive construction of the L2 space. All right? And so what happened was the following. This space by itself just, I mean, so it was recast, if you want, in the language of Q lattices in the work with Mathilde, but I mean, it was already there in the Adelic formulation. And so what happens is the following. What happens is that with this space, okay, with this space of Q lattices, what you get two different things. I mean, you get two things. The first thing that you get is that you do get a spectral realization of the zeros, not only of the Riemann zeta function, but of L functions. And what happens is the reason is that you get L functions and all that is that when you have a Q lattice, something like that, you can compose it with a self-map of Q mod Z to Q mod Z. Now, if you want the automorphisms of Q mod Z as an abstract abelian group, it has a name, okay, and it is, in fact, the group, you know, which is Z at star of invertible elements in the projective limit of Z mod N. And that group actually is exactly what its dual is the group of Grossen characters of AK, I mean, up to a trivial change of variables. So what happens is the following. What happens is that you get an action of this group, and of course you have an action of R plus star. How is R plus star acting? It is acting by scaling. It's a stupid action, you know, really. If you have a Q lattice, you can rescale it. You can multiply by any number. Okay, so you have an action by scaling, and it turns out that if you take some good glasses, you have to, I mean, you shouldn't do it very naively. You really have to take some good glasses. You see, why do you need some good glasses? Because you cannot see an absorption spectrum with bad glasses. And the point is the following. The point is that a single spectral line has measure zero. So what you have to do, and in physics, you know, the reason why we see these absorption lines is that, in fact, there is quantum mechanics behind the scene, and they are not just a set of measure zero. They are a little bit thickened. Okay, they have some natural thickness. Now, to have this natural width of the lines, you have to make a cutoff. So, I mean, in the paper which I wrote back in 98 in Selectar Mathematica, okay, there was a cutoff. There is a cutoff. And this cutoff is manifest by this truncation here. And what was proven there was the following. What was proven is that, in fact, there is a, so there is this space, the space of two lattices up to commensurability. There is an action of this group, the group of, if you want, whose dual is the group of Grossen characters, the group of scaling, these two groups are acting. This group of, whose dual is the Grossen characters give you super selection sectors. The sectors are parameterized by the Ecke characters. And whenever you look at a sector, you will get exactly the spectrum, the absorption spectrum, which is the zeros of the L function given by the thing. But what happens is that the zeros which are on the critical line appear in the spectrum, and the zeros which are not, we don't know. You know, there could be some zeros which are not on the critical line, and they appear exactly as in physics. That means they appear as resonances. So what they give you a resonance. Okay, so they give, if they are there, they give you a resonance. And what I did in this paper, I was not able, of course, to prove the global trace formula, but I showed that there was an equivalence between the validity of the global trace formula, okay, and the Riemann hypothesis. Now, what is the trace formula? The trace formula is quite interesting because on the one hand, it is proved in this paper. It is proved when you simplify the space. So the space, you see, it turns out that this space of Q lattices is localizable at each prime. I mean, when you have a Q lattice, you have a map from Q mod Z, the torsion points, to the torsion points. But there are torsion points which are of order a power of a prime. So you can look at this localized at various primes. And if you only localize it at finitely many primes, okay, then I proved the trace formula. And what was amazing in this trace formula that you get in that case, for finitely many places, if you want, is that they have the trace formula, which is given by this, it has actually a very specific principal value, because this integral is divergent when u is equal to 1. This is the R measure, and so on. And the operator theoretic framework of Q lattices and so on, if you want, prescribes a very specific principal value. And what was convincing, if you want, in this approach, what was convinced me at least, is that this principal value is exactly the same as the principal value which was obtained by André Weil in his reformulation of the Riemann explicit formula. So I remind you of what is the Riemann explicit formula. So the Riemann explicit formula is a formula which allows you to give a formula for the number of primes which are less than x, but much, 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 much better than the formula which I had shown you by Laurent, okay? Because that formula by Laurent was a kind of tautology. But the formula by Riemann is not at all a tautology. So what Riemann tells us is that if you average a little bit, I mean, you can undo that with a Moebius function. It's very simple. So if you average a little bit pi of x, you smooth it a little bit by taking the sum over roots, okay? This sum will stop after a while because pi of 1 is 0. Okay, so what you will get is that pi prime of x, this sum, is in fact exactly given by the integral logarithm of Gauss. Okay, but then you have to subtract from it a sum of the integral logarithm at the powers of x, which are given by the zeros. All right. So of course, if these zeros are on the critical line, these powers are just x 1 half plus something imaginary. So they are oscillating, but you know their size. And then there is a remainder, which is this. Now, you can see this remainder. This remainder is typical of very, very strange principal values that Weil studied in great detail and introduced in what he calls the explicit formulas, which are essentially the Riemann's formula. Okay? And in these formulas, what you have is a sum over all primes, including the prime at infinity, which is, if you want, the Archimedean place. But when you look at the Archimedean place, you have a principal value which involves the Euler constant and log of 2 pi. Now, physicists are very familiar to that because of Dimrègue. In Dimrègue, you also have everywhere the Euler constant and log of 2 pi. Okay? In fact, there is a relation between the two. But what is quite surprising, if you want, what was extremely convincing in this approach of spectral realization is that what you get when you take finitely many places, you get on the nose the same value. Okay? And of course, this is very scary. You have to check it many times and so on. Okay? So what it is telling you is the following. That at least, okay, you know, there is a start. There is a start, namely there is this non-commutative space. There is a rough way, I mean, you know, which is to define L2 for this non-commutative space. But this way of defining L2, the main ingredient that was there in defining L2 was some kind of averaging. But it was, if you want, it was not really using non-commutative geometry. In the sense that it was a very sort of... immediate definition of L2. Okay. And in particular, I mean, this was not so good, because what it meant is that, one couldn't use the tools and so on. I mean, it was saying that there is something there, of course. And there was another reason why it was saying, you know, that, for instance, what people had been looking for in this quantum chaos was entirely there. The other reason was that there is a computation which one can do. One can do on the back of an envelope, and which will convince you that exactly this volume, you know, the formula for the volume, which is in Riemann, if you want, and I mean, Riemann didn't have it as a symplectic volume, of course, but this formula can be interpreted as a symplectic volume, okay? And the reason is very, very simple. So you have the scaling. So the generator of scaling is given by this Hamiltonian. The reason why I put 2 pi is because I use the right Fourier transform to do number theory. You know, when you do number theory, you shouldn't take the Fourier transform exponential I x y, but you should take I 2 pi x y, okay? So that the lattice self-dual and so on. Okay, so when you do that, you can do the calculation, you can do it on the back of an envelope, and what do you find out?
Well, you find that exactly this Riemann formula, e over 2 pi log of e over 2 pi of minus 1. And in fact, even with a 7-8, if you do the computation more carefully, you find exactly the plus 7-8. Okay? So this exactly comes in by the quantum mechanical calculation now of the number of degrees of freedom, okay, which are missing. And they are missing because we are looking at an absorption spectrum. Okay? So you see what is very subtle here is that this counting of Riemann occurs with a minus sign. Again, okay. So it's, if you want, what you do, you are looking at the number of quantum states, okay, in the quantization of the system, which are corresponding to this area here, and what you find out is that this number of quantum state is actually exactly what it should be for white light. For white light, you would get exactly this result, which is the cutoff log lambda times the energy at which you look, okay. However, you have to subtract this term. So, I mean, the term in Riemann is obtained by subtraction, and it is exactly these absorption lines, okay? Now, so, I mean, for some time, you know, I had the hope of being able to prove by brute force this trace formula and all that, and so on. So I tried quite hard with prolate functions and all sorts of things. But, okay, I mean, I think one should be more relaxed and so on, and one should take more advantage of the geometry. And so this is where we started working with Katia Consani and Martin Marcoli on this problem. And I mean, in order to understand the strategies that we have, and we'll see really, you know, that it goes quite far. I mean, the strategy is coming from what happens in the case of where, you know, the analog of the Riemann conjecture is actually proved, which is the case of global fields of positive characteristic. So what happens in that case, there is an analog of the Riemann zeta function. The field is not the field of rational numbers as it was before, okay? It's a field which is also a global field, what is called the global field, all right? But it's a field of rational functions on a curve over a finite field. Okay, and, you know, I don't want to spend any time there. There is an analog of the zeta function. And there, of course, the situation is much better. I mean, this is one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century, which is due to André Weil. Because André Weil was really able to prove that, you know, there is the analog of the Riemann hypothesis is actually true there. And, I mean, I will say a few words about this proof because we'll sort of need that as motivation. But essentially what is going on there, if you want, is that, well, after a lot of more work, you know, after the work of Weil, but what is essentially going on is that behind the scene, there is a cohomology theory, okay, which is not, doesn't meet the eye immediately, but behind the scene, there is a cohomology theory. And the reason why, you know, it's an absorption spectrum, you can, and why there is a minus sign, you can immediately understand it from the cohomology theory standpoint, because we are dealing with a curve, and we have to think of the curve, you know, by analogy, if we think of it as a complex curve, a complex curve has an H0, which is trivial, has an H2, which is trivial, but it has an H1, which is very interesting. And, you know, whose size is governed by the genus of the curve. And when you look at the Euler characteristic, or when you look at any formula like the Lefschetz formula and so on, what you will find out is that the H1 enters but with a minus sign. Namely, it enters, you know, like a minus H1. And this is exactly what happens when you write the zeta function and so on. And, I mean, if you want the proof by Weil, as I will mention very briefly, is essentially based on the fact that there is a cohomology theory, that there is a Lefschetz formula, and that you can keep going on geometric grounds. All right. So, I mean, you know, this is very bad, because then you say, my God, I mean, how are you going to proceed in the case of, we are interested in the case of rational numbers and so on, if the main role is played by this Frobenius, okay, which is a very simple thing. I mean, actually, you know, when you work in characteristic P, it's something just, you take X, you raise X to the P, it turns out to be additive and so on. So, but it's a very, very basic and fundamental thing. All right. And, I mean, you know, as I said, there was another big point which was missed by the first spectral realization and so on, which is that it was not really using non-commutative geometry in the sense that it was taking the L2 space in this very blunt manner, but not really relating it to the essence of the theory. So what I want to describe now, maybe I should do it with a blackboard. I think I prefer to do it with a blackboard. Yes. Okay, so what I want to describe, then I will show you some transparencies, but I want to describe something, you know, which is the essence of the story. And which really should play the role of the Frobenius in characteristic zero, and which will be based now, you know, really on non-commutative geometry in a very essential manner. So if you want, I want to describe an operation that you should know about non-commutative spaces and several features of non-commutative spaces that are essential. So as I said, you know, this is based on a joint work with Katia Consani and Martin Marcoli. And so I suppose you have all heard this phrase that, you know, a non-commutative space has its own type of God-given time evolution. I suppose you have all heard about this, okay? I mean, you know, I sort of built my whole career on this fact, okay? So, I mean, so what does it mean, you know? So this is what sort of started, you know, the theory of classification of factors and all that. So, I mean, by the Tomita theory, we know that if we have a state, then we have a corresponding one-parameter group, okay? But what I proved in my thesis was that, in fact, this one-parameter group does not depend on the state, namely that, in fact, you have, you know, a canonical map which goes from the real line to the group of outer automorphisms of the factor. And, I mean, this map then has periods, it has spectrum, and so on, and all of these periods, spectrum, and so on, are invariants of the corresponding factor. Okay. So that's, you know, when you do measure theory, if you want, that's at the level of measure theory. Okay. But there are finer levels, and, I mean, there is one finer level when you look at things, if you want, from topology and so on. I mean, so if you look, if you want, from the point of view of non-commutative geometry, there is one more step that you can do, and which will be exactly the base here. Okay. So, what I'm going to tell you, a very, very strange story. And I'm going to tell you that you can cool down a non-commutative space, and you can distill it. Okay? And it is this distillation that actually will be the analog then for the scaling of the Frobenius at infinity. Okay? So what do you do? So you are handed a non-commutative space. All right. So, I mean, of course, in general, this non-commutative space which is handed to you comes with a natural measure class. All right? So, if you want, it comes, it's not totally naked. I mean, it comes as an algebra. So you have an algebra, A, algebra. And, okay, I will give you examples very shortly. All right, so you have an algebra. And on top of this algebra, what you have is you have a natural measure or state. Okay, state. Well, and in fact, what I am only interested in is the corresponding time evolution. So sigma t are automorphisms of this algebra. Okay. All right. Now, if you want the relation that exists between the algebra, I mean, you know, between the time evolution rather than the state, so this map, if you want, this relation is a fundamental thing in thermodynamics. Okay, and this fundamental thing in thermodynamics, I don't want to spend any time on it, but it's called the KMS condition. So it's a condition that relates, if you want, essentially a Boltzmann or Gibbs equilibrium state and the time evolution. All right. The beauty about this relation is that it actually involves a parameter, which is beta, which is the inverse temperature. In other words, if you want, in simple, very simple terms, what happens is that you are interested in a state that would be of the form of the Boltzmann form, trace of some observable A times e to the minus beta H, and you want to normalize by trace of exponential minus beta H. But what you see is that there is this parameter beta. Okay? And if you want the relation between the state phi, which is a functional, so it depends on elements of the algebra, okay? So the relation between the state and the time evolution in the Heisenberg form, which is given by sigma t of an observable A, is exponential ith A exponential minus ith. So the relation between the time evolution and the state is exactly governed by this KMS condition. But the KMS condition is very beautiful because it does not only make sense, if you want, when the state is of this form, it makes sense in general. All right.
So what happens now is the following, is that so your space is handed to you. It has a time evolution. And it has a KMS state for inverse temperature 1. Okay? But what you can do, you can cool it down. I mean, you can look for KMS states, okay, at a lower temperature, which means beta bigger. Okay? And now what turns out to be the case is that what you can do is there is a natural morphism, okay, so there is a natural morphism that goes in the cross product of the algebra A by its time evolution, okay, into a new algebra. And this algebra is essentially the following. What you do is you take continuous functions. You take continuous functions, and you take a space, but now it will be a classical space. And what is this space? Well, this space is a space of extreme points of the set of KMS beta states. Now I take beta bigger than 1. Okay? It's not quite enough, because if I take a KMS beta state for beta bigger than 1, I hope it is of this form. But then I have to choose H. And, I mean, you will agree with me that if I add a constant to H, I do not change the state. So I have an ambiguity, which is this constant. All right? And because of this constant, I mean, this space is actually, there is a covering, and there is a covering by the group R plus star. Okay? Now, it turns out that because this operator will be trace class, okay, I mean, if you have a type 1 state, then what you get the algebra of compact operators or trace class operators, and you can take continuous functions on this space with values in compact operators. Okay, let me put compact operators, but I'd rather put L1, I mean, trace class operators. Okay. So you have this map. You have this map rho beta, if you want. Okay. And, then you are in a very interesting situation because you have a map. You have two non-commutative spaces. I mean, you have the space you start with, or rather the cross product by R. Okay, and here you have a classical space, because you have a space which is essentially Morita equivalent to a classical space. All right, and now it turns out that the interesting cohomology, I will say immediately why, that the interesting cohomology is coming, if you want, from the distillation. Namely, this space is obtained by cooling down, it's a classical space, which is obtained by cooling down this non-commutative space. And what you are interested in is neither one nor the other, but the difference between the two. Okay? Now, the difference between the two is not something, we are not in an abelian category. So normally, you are in trouble because you are dealing with non-commutative spaces, they don't form an abelian category. Fortunately, there is a cyclic theory, and the cyclic theory plays the same role as the theory of motifs, if you want. It allows you to embed the category of non-commutative spaces in an abelian category. And then you can take the co-kernel. Right. Now, the main result that we have in this paper with Katia Consani and Mathilde Marcoli is that if you take the very old system, which is called the BC system, which I will flash to you very briefly, the system that I had introduced with Bost many years ago, okay, which is called the BC system. And so it's really a system of quantum statistical mechanics. Okay, so if you take this BC system, it turns out to be equivalent to the space of, you know, Q lattices up to scaling. But, I mean, it's a very concrete system. What it is given by, it's given by the algebra, which is a group ring of Q mod Z. And then you add, you know, relations, which are relations by multiplication by an integer, okay, which are given by the presentation. So there is a very natural non-commutative space. It has this time evolution. And the main result is that when you apply this procedure here, this thermodynamics, you know, procedure, then now you get cohomological interpretation. Okay? And moreover, you get a cohomological interpretation which has the same feature as the etale cohomology, namely it has a natural action of the Galois group, of the absolute Galois group of Q bar over Q. So I want to say a few words about this because this is really an essential point. So I mean, let me remind you of the two essential things. Okay, so the first essential thing is that what you do then, so you do this distillation, what we call distillation, all right? So maybe I should show you transparency. So you, yes. Yeah, so let me prepare this transparency here. So I suppose you all know about this BC system. I mean, it has the following essential properties, that it has spontaneous symmetry breaking. And so yes. Yeah, I can say it in words, it's better. Okay, so what happens is the following then, is that what you do is you take the co-kernel of this map, okay? So the co-kernel of this map doesn't make sense as an algebra. Of course, the co-kernel of a homomorphism of algebras is not, is nothing, okay? But the co-kernel of this map in the cyclic category, it has a cyclic homology, HC0, okay? And when you look at the cyclic homology HC0 of this space, and you look at the obvious action of scaling, you get the spectral realization of the zeros of Riemann zeta function. Okay. Now, so there are many, many striking features, and the most striking feature is the fact that this construction is exactly like Ettal cohomology, namely that it has an action of the Galois group of Q bar over Q. Okay. And how does this come about? Okay. So it comes about from the following thing. That when you look at the BC system, okay, the system with BOST, there was something which was quite striking in this system, which was that when you look, when you classify the KMS states above the critical temperature, there is no phase transition, there is a unique phase, okay, which is very chaotic, which corresponds to a type 3-1 factor. But when the temperature goes down, at some point there is a phase transition. And then there are various phases, but what was very striking was that the phases were parametrized by the Galois group of the cyclotomic extension of Q, or if you want, they were parametrized by embeddings of the fields of roots of unity in the complex numbers. Now, we wanted to have a much, much better understanding of this phenomenon here, of the appearance of the Galois theory, and so this is what we obtained in this paper. So the reason why the Galois theory enters is the following, is that this non-commutative space, which is describing the space of Q lattices, or if you want the BC system and all that, it turns out that the algebra, instead of just being an algebra over C, over the complex numbers, is in fact an algebra over Q. You see, it's sort of obvious here. What is the algebra? It is a group ring of Q mod Z. So it's Q of Q mod Z. Okay, the group ring of Q mod Z, if you want. So what does it mean? It means that you put symbols, E of R, where R is a rational number, and this symbol satisfies, for instance, E of R plus S is equal to E of R, E of S, etc., etc. Okay? So it is a group ring of Q mod Z, but to this group ring of Q mod Z, you adjoin the scaling, okay, multiplication by N. All right? And the rules are very simple. I mean, they are given here. But as we shall see, you know, these rules are in fact, they have a much larger generalization with endomorphisms of algebraic varieties. Now, once you have these rules, okay, you can say, well, I complexify everything and I use Fourier transform to analyze the group ring of Q mod Z and so on and so forth. You are making a big mistake because when you are using Fourier transform, you are not respecting Galois. Because when you are using Fourier transform, you are putting exponential 2 pi I something. And this is not invariant under the Galois group of C over Q. Okay? So we have to use a much finer way of looking at things because we have algebras over Q, not over C. Okay? And when you do that, you find out that, in fact, this whole story, all right, the algebras which are involved are obtained as union of finite dimensional algebras. And these finite dimensional algebras, they fall in what Grothendieck, I mean, what is now called Artin motifs. Namely, they are the simplest examples of motifs. They are zero-dimensional ones. And you might say, because it's zero-dimensional, it's all trivial. But it's not totally all trivial. Why? Because what you have a theorem, which is called the theorem of Galois-Grothendieck, GG. Okay? And what is this theorem telling you? It's telling you in its best form, actually, what is Galois theory. Okay? So what it is telling you, take a field. Well, don't, you know, I mean, don't ask me if the field has some, I mean, just take a field like Q or whatever, okay? Take a field and take now the category of finite dimensional commutative reduced algebra over this field, okay? Now, what the theorem is telling you is that this category is canonically isomorphic to another category, which is a category of continuous actions of the absolute Galois group, namely the Galois group of Q bar over Q, okay, on finite sets, all right? Now, you see what happens. What happens is that if you are very careful and if you keep in mind the fact that all these algebras are finite dimensional over Q and so on, and if you do it very carefully, you will have an action of the Galois group because of this equivalence of categories. And when you pursue this action and so on, you find that it corresponds exactly to the action on the KMS states at temperature zero, okay, and that it gives you, in fact, a canonical action of Galois on the cohomology. Now, what we have shown in this paper is that, in fact, it gives now the explicit formula as a trace formula. So now, as of cohomological meaning. Okay. So if you want, now we have the cohomological meaning for the veil, the Riemann-Weyl explicit formula. And with this cohomological meaning of the Riemann-Weyl explicit formula, I don't have much time. I want to talk a little bit about gravity. Okay. So, I mean, with this explicit formula, what happens is the following, is that apparently it doesn't work in the reverse, or maybe here. No. I don't know. Okay. Doesn't matter. All right. So, I mean, with this explicit formula, what is very tempting to do is, of course, you know, to trace in the proof of Weyl. Because now we have one basic ingredient that we are missing badly before. Namely, we have a cohomology theory which is playing the same role as the et al. Cohomology, which has an action of absolute Galois and which has many, many nice properties. Okay, so, I mean, what we were able to do after that, we were sort of unable, of course, you know, to go much further, but at least what we were able to do was to, first of all, to identify the curve, you know, the points of the curve. So we could identify the points of the curve even in the set of the prime numbers. So if you want, there is a subset of the set of of the Andot motif, I mean what we call the generalization of the Artin motifs, and there is a subset which really looks exactly like the points of the curve over a finite field. You see, the points of the curve over a finite field are the union of the orbits of the Frobenius, and here we have a very similar situation where we have a union of circles of length log p. Now, of course, if you would take just a disjoint union of circles of length log p, that would be absolutely nothing. But this is sitting inside the non-commutative space, in the boundary. And it's exactly this where the Lefschetz formula and also it's exactly the place where everything happens, in the explicit formula. So we have identified, if you want, a non-commutative space, which exactly serves the right purpose of having a Lefschetz formula and giving a geometric meaning to the explicit formula. And moreover, now, what happens, if you want, is that one can exactly write down the analogy with the Weyl proof, okay, which I don't want to pass, but what one can do is write a dictionary. So it turns out that one can actually spell out a dictionary between the various steps. So this we do at the end of the paper. So it turns out, if you want, that one can see, you know, the Weyl proof is not long. But it's extremely tricky. Namely, it takes about 2 pages, but it turns out, if you want, that in these 2 pages, there is a lot of work which is actually done. I mean, it's some people will tell you it's simple. Well, it's not so simple, because there are several steps, and the main step is to take the Frobenius correspondence. We have correspondences in non-commutative geometry. They're there. We have the exact analog of the Frobenius correspondence. We have the analog of the cohomology, okay? And we have a step which we call the Frobenius step, which is very important, which allows to get the right degree for the correspondence. But what we are missing, basically, is, if you want, in the proof of Weyl, the division by principal divisors. I mean, it's really one of the basic steps which is missing. Okay. So this is the situation. It is a paper which is about 1 year old. Okay. And so I am finishing to write a book with Mathilde Marcoli, and this book has 2 parts. So it has 1 part on physics. So it's a book about non-commutative geometry and, you know, and physics and number theory. So it has 1 part on physics. And in this part on physics, the main content is the content of the class which I gave here. Namely, well, there is a part on renormalization, you know, on the role of motifs in renormalization and so on. And then there is this part on the standard model and the fact that, you know, one can recover the standard model coupled with gravity from non-commutative geometry by using spectral triples and all that. Okay.
Then there is this part on number theory, which I explained, you know, which in particular describes the joint work with Katia Kanzani and all that, and the work on spectralization. Actually, when we were sort of finishing the book, we were quite amazed to see that there was an interrelation between these two pieces, okay, which is the subject of my talk. So, of course, you know, the title, it's QG and RH. I mean, it's a little bit striking that if you take the next letter after Q and G, you know, you get RH, okay? So that was the pun, okay? Now, what is quite striking, what is very, very striking, is that, you know, when you look, you find out that this system that I had defined with Bost, actually, I mean, has higher dimensional generalizations, and the GL2 system and the system with complex multiplication and so on. So, I mean, now it has been explored by a number of people, and so here I just put a table, if you want, which shows generalization from the idea of Q lattices from the system with Bost, which is the first column, to the what is called the GL2 system, which is very, very interesting, which has so very surprising features for phase transitions, and what happens for fields of, with complex multiplication. But I mean, what was really striking was to see that, if you want, the main ingredient of all these constructions was KMS and spontaneous symmetry breaking. I mean, this was the essential ingredient. And then, okay, there was this idea of the distillation, the cooling down, and all that. Okay? Now, in the work on the standard model, on which I talked about here, it turned out that at some point, with Ali Shamseddin and Martin Marcoli, we had to look at what is called the electroweak phase transition, which is supposed to happen in cosmology at some point. Okay? So what is supposed to happen is the following, is that you have a phase transition in the sense that you have the potential for the X field, which is roughly speaking a symmetry breaking potential, where you have a symmetry like a rotational symmetry, and the vacuum actually breaks the symmetry. Okay? Now what is supposed to happen is that when temperature of the universe was much bigger, okay, then there is no potential of this type, there is a unique minimum, and there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. And it's only, if you want, when the temperature lowers, that you have this spontaneous symmetry breaking. So it's a long story. It's a long story, a long, very detailed story. The story of this spontaneous symmetry breaking. And but it's quite amazing that it contains exactly the same ingredients as, if you want, what we have. Namely, the first ingredient is KMS, but in a different form in physics. I mean, what happens in physics, if you want, is that the KMS condition is giving you periodic boundary condition in the Euclidean functional integral. And so what happens is that one does the computations in physics, and one finds that there is something which is called, the effective potential. You compute the effective potential, you compute the corrections, and you find that there is this phenomenon. Okay? That's what you find. Now, so I just want to show you a table. Yes. Okay. So what happens is that when you find that there is this thing that KMS is entering, and so on. Well, there is a kind of dictionary which is beginning to emerge, and where, if you want, the sort of framework of spectral triples, which is absolutely essential in order to recover the standard model coupled with gravity, turns out to be almost the same as the framework of Q lattices. And the phase transition which is occurring from the electroweak symmetry breaking to be exactly on a par to the phase transition which is occurring with Q lattices. Okay? And I mean, in this dictionary, it's quite amazing to see what happens, because, for instance, there is in this dictionary that we are building with a veil proof, one of the basic ingredients is the correspondences, which is the notion of morphism for motifs. Okay? And when you look at what should be the framework for quantum gravity from the point of view of spectral triples, what you find out is that the spaces themselves are not the essential object. what really should be the essential object, there should be the correspondences between spaces. Okay? And now, in this set of Q lattices, what was essential, the essential thing was the scaling. Okay? Now, you can wonder how, what is the role of the scaling in gravity and all that, you know, and scaling of what? Now, it turns out to be scaling of the Dirac operator. All right? And I was very struck to see that when you look at the information we have about the universe, it's all spectral, first of all. And second of all, the redshift is not just the shift of the frequency, it's a scaling of the frequencies. And it's a scaling of the frequencies which can be as large as a factor of 1,000. I mean, you know, this is something one has to take in. So what it means is that you take the spectrum and you rescale it, and you rescale it by a factor of up to 1,000. Okay? Now, so what happens is that one can go very far in this dictionary. I didn't have any time when I was discussing the three systems and GL2 systems and so on. It turns out that the main role, and the main role to define the arithmetic and the arithmetic subalgebra that was defined over Q, is played by the Eisenstein series. But it turns out that the Eisenstein series have a perfect analog in the spectral model, you know, the model of gravity coupled with standard model, and they are given by spectral functions which are just the trace of inverse powers of Dirac. So it turns out, if you want, that there is an amazing dictionary, and this dictionary has the value it has in mathematics, you know, the dictionaries have the value of suggestion. Analogies have a tremendous value because they suggest some ideas which you would never have if you were just sitting on your desk and making computations. And here, there is one idea which is totally new and which you would never get on the right-handed column if it was not for the left-handed column. What is this idea? So I will finish with this idea. It's an idea about gravity. And this idea about gravity is the following. It is that, first of all, the spontaneous symmetry breaking that occurs in the electroweak phase transition is only a very, very small tip of the iceberg of a spontaneous symmetry breaking that occurs in gravity in general. Namely, what we should think of is that we have the space of all geometries. Okay? On that space of all geometries, we have an action, which is a spectral action, which is invariant and so on. Okay? And the spontaneous symmetry breaking is actually a spontaneous symmetry breaking that not only chooses the vacuum of the Higgs field, but chooses the geometry itself. Okay? And, I mean, this is only possible because of the spectral action, because the spectral action is defined on the set of all geometries. So that's the first hint, okay? But there is a second hint which is much stronger than that. And the second hint which is much stronger than that is that when you look at the statistical mechanics of the Q lattices and all that, what you will find out is that the situation is that there is a critical temperature. There are several, in fact, when you look at higher dimensional Q lattices. So there are several critical temperatures. But when you look below the critical temperature, okay, I mean, at lower temperature, then there has been a spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay, and there you are in a specific phase. So the idea now that you get on the other column is the following, is that it's probably foolish to try to quantize gravity coupled with a standard model on a fixed background geometry. For the following reason, that what this analogy suggests is that, in fact, there is a temperature which is high enough and beyond which there is no geometry at all. There is no universe at all. What there is a type 3-1 chaotic quantum state on the space of all geometries, which doesn't correspond to any specific geometry. It corresponds to a perfectly symmetrical state, and it's only when things are cooled down that it deposits and it chooses a specific geometry. And then, okay, there are perhaps several phase transitions, like the electroweak phase transition and so on. So I hope I have convinced you, you know, of several things. One thing is that, you know, non-commutative geometry can be extremely useful in things like number theory, you know, like Riemann zeta function. And, okay, I spent my whole class in this program, you know, explaining about the standard model. But what I think is essential, you know, is that indeed we see in this analogy and so on, okay, that probably, I mean, it's not a total accident that, you know, there are these two basic spaces, the space of prime numbers and space-time. And, you know, as I was saying, that there is, in fact, a tremendous power which is very probably impossible to reach by computers and all that. I mean, computers will probably replace us as far as doing fast computations and all that. That's fine. But I don't think they will ever replace us as far as exactly this prototype of thing, which is an analogy, you know. An analogy where if you had somebody really trying to, you know, pin you down in the room and so on, and would tell you, oh, but fine. I mean, we don't care, you know. we are not asking the analogy to be 100% precise, no. What we want is, we want the power of the analogy is to set the brain into motion, okay? And to make you think about some new ideas and to set you, to give you some momentum to think about something. Okay, so I think.
Well, I know we're going to be late for our coffee later on, but yeah. Let's have a couple of minutes for questions. Okay, I can see.
Yeah, no, oh, Sean, yes.
Well, is there an analogy for the Riemann hypothesis for
quantum gravity? Yeah, you know, that's a very good question, because one thing which I, you know, which, okay, it will require a lot of work, actually. It will require a lot of work to find out what is the analog of this Frobenius, you know. What I explained is that there is a way to distillate a non-commutative space, okay, and from that to obtain a cohomology theory. Now, I don't know what this will give in quantum gravity. I have no idea. We have to go further. I mean, we have to actually make this geometric model of quantum gravity with spectral triples, spectral correspondences, much finer. Of course, we have to be guided by the standard model case, which is very concrete. Okay? And then once we make this model much more concrete, we'll have to compute the phase transitions, which is tremendous. I mean, you know, it's very hard. For instance, the case of the phase transition for the GL2 was only settled recently. I think there will be several talks by HAF and Nadia Larsen and so on. But, you know, it's all very difficult to compute these phase transitions and to come to a stable point and all that. So what I believe is that in the case of quantum gravity, indeed, you know, we shall have to compute this phase transition. And in each of the phase transitions, we'll have to compute the corresponding cohomology. You see, it's not like you have only one cohomology, because you have one cohomology per phase transition. And there are systems, like the GL2 system has two phase transitions. It has one phase transition at beta equals 1 and a phase transition at beta equals 2. So, I mean, you know, it's wide open. I mean, this construction, it works in the case of the BC system. It gives a spectral realization of the zeros of the Riemann zeta. Now, of course, it should be extended, and we have a definition of endomotives in more general cases, and it has not been computed in more general cases. And one should be very open, you know, to, you know, what will happen. So this is why this analogy is very enticing, you know, because exactly, I mean, there are things which are far, very far advanced on one side, and things which are not here, but there are things on this side which are very far advanced, like the fact that there is an action functional, there is a beginning, you know, of writing a functional integral and so on, and which do not exist on the left-hand side. So, I mean, the idea is that they will enhance each other. I mean, this is the hope.
Yes, I expected you to speak of the random matrices in connection with this.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, fine. I mean, I didn't have time. You know, I didn't have time to... Of course.
To have them.
Of course. Yeah, sure. The random matrices are in the back. And I mean, the hope, indeed, I mean, you know, is that in the quantum gravity, I mean, the D will be a random symplectic matrix. And I mean, this is what we hope. And this should make a lot of computations actually possible.
So yes. You think that it's possible to kill the space by warming it?
By cooling it.
No, when you cool it, it appears.
Ah, yeah, it appears classical. You see, the point is the following. Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, the idea is the following, is that, you know, the higher the temperature, the more quantum, I mean, the more sort of non-commutative the space is. I prefer to say, okay? And then when you cool it down, what happens is it's a simple lemma that we prove in this paper, that if you have a KMS state, which is type 1, it remains. Namely, if you cool further, it remains there. Namely, it follows. If it's type 3, no, it can disappear. But if it's type 1, because it's written by trace of e to the minus beta h, if you increase the beta, the state will still be there. It will not disappear. Okay?
My question
yes.
was...
Oh, going up. Okay, I mean, when you go up, if you go to infinite temperature, at infinite temperature, you have traces and all that. And okay. But I mean, what happens, for instance, for the GL2 system is very strange. Because the naive idea would be, you know, that above a certain temperature, you have a unique state, and below the critical temperature, you have many. That's a wrong idea, because if you look at the GL2 system, what happens is that there is a second critical temperature, and above that second critical temperature, there is no state at all. You see? So it's not like,
So in that case, disappears. I mean, there is nothing. You know, there is nothing. There is no equilibrium state at all. So I mean, and we can expect very strange. For instance, what you find is that for GLN system. So this is for GL2 system, but for GLN system, it's a very strange thing because for GLN system, you have a first temperature, then you have an interval where you have unique, and then you have no. But at every integral point, you have some. So it's, you know, it's, we can expect very, very new and interesting situations.
Okay, well, I think we should thank the speaker again.